this thing called proxy. I know that Wes knows about this, you know, proxy, which allows you to edit with a preview resolution, and then you can render it at the full resolution.
You say do.
Okay, Wesley, you want to say a couple of words about proxy?
Yeah, if you have an image or a series of images in movie that you're trying to create, or a YouTube video, and it's not rendered yet, sometimes the computer is not able to handle, especially if it's not hardware accelerated, but it's software accelerated. Then some programs offers you easy way to get out of it. So you actually, for the purpose of editing, you're actually decreasing the resolution of the picture viewed. In other words, the program is not seeing all of that heavy stuff that is being processed. But from now, it is just getting quite a different file that is used for doing your changes. After you do your cuts and make that video or that film, then you're rendering it. But the rendering is done in the format that is intended to be the end of effect. So if you have a 4K video, 6K video, 8K video, and you want to have a certain format for it, right? So 256, 255, 254, that would be the typical one, but there are a number of formats made for professionals. You have a ProRes, let me just... Or you have a file that was made in DaVinci RAW. RAW is like a RAW meat, a RAW file. When you look at RAW, you have a feeling like you're looking at something that is extremely bad in quality. All of the colors are very fainted, but when you put on it the proper color in coloring, that DaVinci Resolve 17.4 version, then you're getting all of the rich information out of it. But again, the form of editing that allows you to use weak computer to process it is actually proxy and TechShare.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Ed, are you still out there? K2GJE, we were waiting for you to come back to talk about your taskbar. Oh, well, nothing heard. I hope it's just that Ed has better things to do tonight at 9:10, and hopefully he fixed his taskbar. Maybe next Sunday night he'll tell us if the fix worked for him. But we'll have to leave it a mystery, I guess. David, any further comments?
KD2VHD, checking in late.
Okay, recognized. Do you have any questions tonight, or are you just checking in?
I have a medical question if you have time for it, or can wait for next week.
Okay, I'll put you on the list, and when we get down to it, you can ask it, okay?
Roger. KD2VHD, standing by.
QSL, Roy. I'm finished. Have a great night. KG2RY.
Okay, very good. Chris, K2SCP, hopefully you're still around and you still have a question?
Yes, I am, Roy. Thank you. K2STP. It's kind of a follow-up question to a previous one a few weeks ago. I asked about the effects of putting T's in coax feed lines. And, of course, we came up with AR splitters and can degrade the signal. So along the same lines, what are the effects or negative, obviously there's no positive, I don't think, of using different coax feed lines, in other words, mixing different coax in a feed line. So for example, if you had 50 feet of LMR 400, a very low loss, good coax, and then you have after that 20 feet of say something else like RG-58 or LMR-240, something thinner, and then connecting that to the transmitter. What are the negative effects? Is it just you're going to get the performance of the lowest lost cable, so in this case the thinner LMR-240, for example, or is there some other effects? Can it change the phase or something more technical? So that's the basic question. What's the effects of mixing two different kinds of coax cable, assuming they're all 50 ohm? K2STP.
RG58 is 75 ohm. That is impedance mismatch. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Anyway, yeah, they're all 50 ohms, as far as I'm aware, Wesley. As long as you keep the impedances identical, there should be no phase changing that wouldn't have changed. As we mentioned before, if you have an antenna that's perfectly 50 ohms, then the length of the coax cable doesn't affect the impedance at all. But if you have a mismatch and the antenna system, the antenna feed point is not 50 ohms, then the mismatch impedance sort of rotates along the wavelength ratio, and the phase angle shifts, and some phase angles you can correct with an antenna tuner and some you can't. But now that you put everything on 50 ohm impedance, the only thing that changes is the power handling capability and the attenuation loss. And the attenuation loss is dependent upon the portion of the coax cable. If you have two, if you put together two coax, one is LMR 400, and the other is say it's 90 feet, and then 10 feet of RJ58, you will have more attenuation loss at a high frequency for that 10 feet, but it's only the 10 feet where that amount of attenuation loss is a factor. For the length at the LMR 400, it'll have the same attenuation loss as if it was not connected to any other transmission line. And also, if you have a transmission line that's not capable of carrying that much current, you risk overheating the transmission line. So that's an absolute. Once you have something that's very, very thin and can't take a kilowatt of power, you can burn out that portion of the transmission line.
Okay, yeah, I understand the power handling of each cable would obviously affect that portion. So is this correct? So just, I don't know if these numbers are correct, but let's say they were. If I had 20 feet of, let's say, RG58, which I believe is 50 ohms, by the way, Leslie, I think it's RG59 is 75. If I'm not mistaken, I'm going off the top of my head. But let's say I had 20 feet of 58, and let's just say it was, for the example, it's 2 dB of loss on that distance. And then we had 50 feet of LMR 400, and let's say that was 1 dB of loss. So would it say if I put them together and had 70 feet, 20 and 50, would the total loss be 3 dB? Because you can just add them together. Is that correct, or is it something different than that?
AC2GX. No, you just add them together. It's very, very simple math, thank God. And as you mentioned, the RJ-59 is 75 ohm. It's used for cable networks because 75 ohms has the least power drop, and that's what's important to cable operators. A cable impedance of something like 30 ohms would have more power handling capability. But since cable operators don't really deal in high power, they're more interested in just loss figures. So that's why RG59 is 75 ohms. But RG58 is 50 ohms.
Comment?
Yes, comment away.
Alpha Charlie 2, Papa Lima. Good evening, Rick. Yeah, don't forget the connectors, high-quality connectors. You won't get as much loss, but if you're just using stuff off the shelf and you're, you know, making your own or home-brewing or whatever, you're going to end up with a dB for each connector you add to a daisy chain of coax QSO.
I got to show you a couple of YouTubes where they put together about 12 or 14 connectors and get less than 1 decibel of drop. Unless it's a really bad connector, you're not going to get that much of a loss. You know, people say, well, UHF is not impedance match, so you'll have an impedance mismatch, but it's such a small section of the transmission line that the amount of loss, unless it's a really terrible connector, is usually inconsequential.
Yeah, that's good. I'd really like to look at that video. But the quality and the manufacturing standard of connectors, especially coming off of eBay and for various purposes that we try to repurpose, and the old ones that we find at Hamfest are not all necessarily of highest quality. I think you might agree.
Yeah, I mean, as in all things, you let the buyer beware. I have heard people who have gotten UHF connectors where the thread count was a little bit off, so they couldn't quite screw it in right, or it just didn't feel quite right. So, yeah. But you know, I'm just taking the best case scenario that you have a decent collection of connectors. You've worked with them before. You put them on the side. And, you know, don't worry that it's twice, you know, make it weatherproof, certainly, because I think that's one of the bigger problems with putting a connector in line with a transmission line. You want to make sure that it's weatherproof, because if moisture gets into the line, you'll get a lot of loss. But I'll get those YouTubes. I've seen them. They usually pop up a new version of that at least once a year, so I'll look up a few and I'll send it to you.
Outstanding. Thank you very much, Roy. Happy holidays, happy new year, and back to net. Again, thank you for what you do here.
You're welcome, Jeff. Happy new year, happy, healthy new year. Be well, and we'll keep doing this until we find something better to do, I guess. So thanks. So, Chris, any further questions on this?
No, that pretty much covers it, and in my case, yeah, I'm using very good connectors, and I thought of that part. The only part I didn't understand is what the different cables, how they may or may not interact using a lower cable. So in my case, I come down the side of my house from the antennas, which are about 50 feet up in the air. And then I have a lightning arrestor mounted on the wall right before it goes into the shack. And after the lightning arrestors, I have a conduit that goes into the house. And that conduit, of course, isn't gigantic. So I'm running 6 different LMR 400 cables, and they don't all fit back up that conduit. And that's why, on a few cases, I dropped that cable down to something smaller. I didn't use 58, but I think I used LMR 240. And I was just curious about what effect that would have, and that's interesting. And yeah, I have good connectors on the lightning arrestors. It's all weatherproofed in a box, and it's got atomic tape, so that's all good. So I thank you, appreciate it, and you can move on. Back to you, Roy. Thank you. K2STP.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I can't remember what net it was, but going way back, I remember Dick talking about this, and he said, well, like in his case, he runs hard line all the way up to up his tower, and then you can't, you know, take this hard line, and you know, it's not flexible, so you change it to some other cable that's flexible to tie into his antennas, so apparently it's done all the time. I think he made the statement that, you know, even, you know, professional installations are done like this, too. Back to you.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed, how are you? I thought we lost you.
K2GJE, could I talk for a minute?
Certainly, Ed, feel free.
I have to say thank you to the ham community and those that gave me a hint. Icons on the right side of the task bar on the bottom or shelf was stacked three high. I kept on moving them, actually deleting them, and they got moved to the recycle bin. Some of them that I needed, I left it on the recycle bin, and some of them I then moved back to the screen from the recycle bin until the task bar was empty. The last item was the clock, which was on three levels. I deleted the clock, and then I was able to reduce the size of the height of the task bar, and then I brought the clock back, and it was just on a single line. I have to say thank you to the ham community. Over.
AC2GS. Well, I'm so happy to hear the TechNet was able to assist you in this, and everything's back in ship shape. And great news. Thanks to Chris and to Ken and to other people that are not coming to mind who offered suggestions as well. We all appreciate it. So glad to hear it.
Thanks again. I think my blood pressure is now back to normal. I can work with the machine this way. I don't know why it did what it did, but there was some kind of computer glitch. So it's doing what it has to do. I do some accounting, and I needed it so badly this time of year to cooperate. Thank you again, everybody. Over.
You're welcome, Ed. I just want to clear up something. At the very beginning of this, I thought you mentioned that you had grabbed the taskbar and you had moved it to one of the sides of the screen. Is that what happened? And then when you put it back down, you had this problem? Or did I confuse that?
K2GJE, I was working in Excel, and all of a sudden, the task bar wound up vertical on the right side of the screen. I then took the task bar and dragged it back to the bottom of the screen. And that's when all hell broke loose. Over.
Okay, that makes sense. And that goes back to Chris K2STP's suggestion of what might have happened, that for whatever reason, when the task bar went from horizontal to vertical, you then had less space for the icons, so it decided to stack them, and then when you dragged it back down, unfortunately, it wasn't smart enough to unstack them. So that's probably how that happened.
Thanks again. I didn't know how to unstack them. And I don't know if I did it right, but it worked. I cleaned up the task bar, and then I was able to reduce it in height. Thanks again, everybody. And I think I can now stop sweating. Over.
K2STP.
Yes, Chris.
Just because we're on that subject, to the gentleman and anyone else listening, that area on the right side of the task bar, where the clock is and a few little icons, that's called the system tray area.
so that is treated a little bit different than the regular bar, and that's why it has separate options. And I also wanted to, back to my question, Paul mentioned that was discussed in the past, and I do remember Dick discussing both my exact question, mixing cable coax, and also I do remember him clearly saying he had no problem with connectors as long as they're a good quality connector and they're soldered or crimped properly. You could stack them like you said. I've seen those YouTube videos of stacking 10 of them and it has almost no effect. But the one part of class I was not paying attention to and Dick talked about it was mixing the cables. So thanks for that. K2SDP.
Well, Chris, I mean, often Dick would discuss how he got a great deal on 75-ohm impedance coax cables, and he found that they worked just as well for him as 50-ohm impedance low-loss cables that he would have to pay for. So that would upset a whole bunch of people down on 75 meters.
Oh, I'm sure it would. I have a lot of fun talking to the guys on 75 meters every night, as Andy knows. I've talked to him a few times on there, but good group of guys, a lot of knowledge. K2SDP.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm glad we got through two interesting questions and hopefully gave some thinking material for the people listening, a little history of Windows XP, an operating system, like I said, I haven't probably thought about for at least 15 years, if not 20, but it's all good. Next on our list for tonight is Wesley, N2XJN. What's your topic for tonight, Wesley?
Kind of controversial, N2XJN. I sent you the email about William Beatty. I'm not sure if I probably pronounce his last name Beatty.
I would assume Beatty would be the appropriate way to pronounce it. I haven't had a chance to read it because I've been busy doing this technet. So you sent it something like 8:35. So I haven't had a chance to even look at it.
Yeah, so the gentleman works in the University of Washington. He was a number of programs. He's not a professor, but working under principal investigators, very active since 90s. A number of articles, also in Quora, and even scientific papers. And he's kind of open person. He talks about himself, his childhood, and his hobbies. And his hobby is science, actually radio waves. So we know that he's in biophysics, he's in physics, he is in programming. But then the first contact that I had with him, he was very much careful, was at one of the forums. Actually, he is at EEV blog, that Australian guy. That was actually done by one of my colleagues. He was contacting me, and he finally was blocked on that forum for picking up some subjects. But the guy is very cautious. But it's not the matter how rightful he is or righteousness of his thesis. It's about the problems that he's pointing at, and those problems are very much unique. So, between some of them are some articles that sound criticals. And that's what I would like to talk about it. He's talking about energy sucking radio antennas. He is talking about possibility that electromagnetic radiation lacks quanta of any kind. He's also talking about himself that he works from 9 to 5 on programming jobs, but I'm not sure. And there is some of the bio of that guy. And now we have in Quora, what is the difference between, oh no, that's not that. In Quora we have, how does the receiver antenna physically receive the waves? So I wouldn't really be concentrating on what he's saying, but then he says, transmit in order to receive. So in order to receive, you need to transmit. And that is kind of, from one hand, what the heck the guy is talking about? From the other hand, you're trying to look at him like, not like a moron, but maybe he has some right in what he says. And I'm going to read you a part of it.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure that Dick, K2RIW, discussed this at one point or another, that the best you can get from a receiving antenna is 50% of the signal. Because half of the received signal gets re-radiated by the antenna, because the antenna is a radiating object. So people already know that receivers don't kind of suck in 100% of the signal they receive.
But it's one part of the story. I wasn't arguing with Dick at that time. So what the William Beatty says, the basic principle is from optics, in order to receive you must transmit, and also the process of EM absorption is partially a process of EM scattering. When radio waves hit your antenna wires, they induce charge separation and charge flow, which end up as a volt amps on the leading wires connected to your radio receiver. But as this happens, the antenna flowing and imbalanced charges are producing their own E field, B field, and the antenna starts to radiation its own, listen to that, sphere wave. I'm going to repeat the last sentence. But as this happens, the antenna flowing and imbalanced charges are producing their own E field and B field, and the antenna starts to radiating its own sphere waves. So the problem that I have with this part is sphere waves. Do you have the same problem? And to actually,
no one cares.
Well, getting to the question, I don't have the faintest idea what a sphere wave is. The closest to reality I could come up with is that electromagnetic waves are elliptically oriented, polarized. You know, when we say that something is horizontally polarized or vertically polarized, in a perfect world, it would be a straight line. We don't live in a perfect world, so they're actually ellipses with the long axis either horizontal or vertical. So I could understand an elliptical wave. I cannot understand a spherical wave.
So let's go to the point of line, point of charge and line of charge. The point of charge, the point line. Oh, maybe you can tell me what is the point of charge.
I'm not quite sure what he's alluding to. He has no illustrations, and he doesn't seem to be using standard nomenclature, which is a real big problem. Which could be easily explained by the fact that he's probably more a computer programmer than he is a quantum electrodynamics professor.
Yeah, well, a point of charge. We were talking about it's a point. So you have a point, and a point of charge is an idealized model of the particle which has an electric charge. A point of charge is an electric charge at the mathematical point and with no dimension. So fundamental equation of electrostatic is Coulomb's law, which describes the electric force between the two point charges. If we have a two-point charges, but one single point of charge creates a spherical wave. That would be at least not a spherical pattern of wave propagation. That would be sphere from the point. But then we have something like our antenna that you have on vertical antenna, dipole antenna. And I'm going to talk about line of charge. So line of charge have a physical size in one direction. Let's say your radio antenna at your car. And remember the old times when that antenna was 1/4 wave long for your FM radio, which distributes the charge along the direction. The only thing that is physically exists is a volume change, or volume charge. Everything else is an approximation to simplify the math if we try to make a math, but we don't. We're trying to keep it simple. Now, line of charge, which is your vertical antenna, produces spherical waves, or rather, say, the spherical pattern of propagation. So point of charge makes a spherical wave. Line of charge make cylindrical waves. So you could picture it as the cylinders with the bigger and bigger and bigger size. That would be your pattern of propagation.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
I don't know any electrical engineer who uses these phraseologies. Electromagnetism, I don't understand. Unfortunately, he's kind of using some way of describing something that is completely foreign to me, and I would assume anyone with an electrical engineering or physics degree. I could be wrong. Cylindrical? It's not cylindrical. So I have problems with his nomenclature. I think they're very unstandard. I think he kind of made them up. So that's a problem for me. When, there's 100,000 electrical engineers and physicists, and there's this guy making words up.
No, the cylindrical pattern of radiation is not something that is foreign. It's very much used, and I can send you the links about the scientific nomenclature. But it's not his words. I'm actually fighting with his words. What I'm trying to do is say that a part of his article that is saying about antenna, receiving antenna re-radiating in the received wave, which what Dick stated, in form of cylindrical waves. And that is a problem that I have because it doesn't match. It simply doesn't exist. But that's his way of interpreting it. So I'm actually challenging the article, but there are more of it. The only what is interesting in this guy is he is not orthodox. That means he is giving me additional problems to think about it just because of what I think is his error. So what he says is we diagram this form of this as we find that the antenna on emitted sphere waves are out of phase with the incoming waves being received, producing interference pattern. For downstream from the antenna, the two waves cancels out, forming a broad node of EM shadow. Energy is missing from the shadow. It is the same energy absorbed by the antenna and will find it flowing along the lead in wire on its way to radio receiver. So overall reception process goes like the incoming electromagnetic wiggle, which cancels out some pattern absorbing energy. Yet at the same time, some reflected backward from the antenna. But interesting is he is not Orthodox. About antenna, receiving antenna transmits. So the certain amount antenna, and then antenna part of the. The receiving circuit, so that would be antenna, goes through the coax. Is that what the Dick said?
KC2GS. Well, unfortunately, Wesley, someone was rather talkative behind you and doubled with you repeatedly, so I missed out on about three quarters of what you were saying. I did a quick little Google research for cylindrical RF waves and came up with pretty much nothing. They wanted to discuss acoustic waves. They wanted to discuss waveguides. So again, I'm kind of left in the dark. I'm not quite sure of his nomenclature. I got the assumption that he is not a highly regarded professional in the field, but a guy with an opinion. There's a lot of people with opinions, and I have a line about opinions, but it's not FCC cleared. So I will not share it with people. If they want to email me, I will send them a copy, because the email is not censored. But nevertheless, I'm not quite sure what the question was. It's problematic when you cite a guy who just kind of is sitting on a rock someplace thinking stuff up, who doesn't have well-documented, well-diagrammed, well-explained material. It could be amazing, a change in the entire nature of technology, but much more likely it's the ramblings of a person who's a little bit confused or confabulating. I don't know. I don't know him. I don't know his theory. I don't particularly relish the words he used, because they might exist in an archaic form. If I go back to 1842, I might find spherical waves, I don't know. But recently, you're not going to see much in the way, at least I couldn't find much in the way of spherical waves.
It's rather short of the spherical pattern, not spherical wave, it's a spherical pattern. But spherical pattern is... You gotta do the search as a spherical pattern for point of charge, or a cylindrical wave for line of charge. You're gonna find. But let's go a little bit wider than this. And I have two things to discuss. If we have a Yagi antenna, then we're dealing with reflector, driven element, and direct. But they reflecting back. The talk of the energy, still dealing with the antenna, then that gift, or maybe of
Wesley,
go ahead.
Someone apparently wants to say things under you, and so I don't really get most of what you're saying. Would you like maybe to kind of, I don't know, rest it for 5-10 minutes? I'll take the next person, and we'll come back to you, and we'll try again. Maybe the gentleman will find some better use of his time.
Definitely. Definitely, let's do this. The only what I have in mind is the MRI, which is an MR that has a transmitter and receive antenna. Maybe you as a doctor could say a few words about it. And eventually the Yagi antenna. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Well, we'll get back to you. So, Jim, WA2VHD, you have a question tonight, right?
I do, Dr. Roy, and if it's too obscure for answering tonight, I can take the answer next week, but it's a topic I'd like to bring up. It sounds obscure, but I think it has some relevance to today's, the news of the day. So, is it called lacrimal in punctum, lacrimal punctum, lacrimal punctum. It's a structure, anatomical structure in the eyelids. I'm curious if you know what it is, what it does, and what it has to do with transporting airborne contaminants and pathogens in our bodies. If you're not suited, prepared to answer it today, perfectly good answer next week. And by the way, a comment, the coax discussion was incredibly informative. I've been wondering those questions for quite some time. It was quite good to hear some input on that. So there's the question. I'll take it and listen.
Okay, very good, Jim. Actually, it kind of goes back to a puzzle question that I never got around to asking people of how many different places you could get infected with COVID virus. And one of them is the place that you mentioned, the lacrimal punctum. The reason why is that is exposed, that's where your tear ducts drain into your nose. If you tear up too much, you notice that your nose runs. So it is an actual internal connection between your eye and your oropharynx, which is the same place that you can get a COVID infection from. So if someone were to, say, cough in your eye through your lacrimal punctum, it would drain then into your nasal cavity and into your oropharynx and into your trachea and into your bronchi, and away we go. You get an infection. So I hope that answers the question.
It does, Roy. It's interesting that 2 years into the game we're in, I only first heard of this a couple of days ago. It sounds like it's something that we should be talking about more often, amongst other things. But it was nice to hear your synopsis of it. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. I mean, if you've ever noticed in hospitals, they make a point, in addition of protecting their nose and their mouth, which are two major openings, they usually have eye protection. They have one of those transparent plastic sheets covering their eyes, and that's the reason why, because that's another route of infection. It's a shame it didn't come up. Like I said, I usually have a bunch of little puzzle questions, and when I need them, I throw them out, but after a while, they tend to get stale, and I figure the last anyone wants to hear as a puzzle is something about COVID-19, so I kind of retired that one.
K2SDP?
Yes, Chris.
Been pretty rough, but thank you very much. Thanks for answering my question, and wish everybody a happy holidays. I'll be listening on the side.
Okay, very good, Jim. Have a happy, healthy new year, and I hope you continue to participate in this little journey of ours. Chris, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, thanks, Roy. I just wanted to thank you for more great news. Now I got to wear goggles when I go to 7-Eleven to get a coffee. K2SDP.
Well, I don't want to expand on this too much and violate FCC rules, but there is a... The way that coronavirus works, as people already kind of know, is the spike protein is designed to fit into a certain angiotensin-converting enzyme slot. You don't have to worry about what angiotensin is or what a converting enzyme might be. But it basically attaches to mucous membranes. So you have mucous membranes in your eyes, you got mucous membranes in your nose, you got mucous membranes in your mouth. You have one other place for mucous membranes, but thankfully, human beings have good taste, so they wear underwear and pants and skirts and all kinds of things. Otherwise, you'd have to protect that end of you as well. Okay, once again, this is AC2GS. Perhaps we will try again, Wesley. If you want to kind of jump to another subject, maybe that'll make people happier. I don't know. Yeah, once again, this is AC2GS. Wesley, are you out there?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
On your website, you had a subject about RNA, and this one was S, Sierra RNA, somehow is able to lower people's cholesterol. You know, it looks like, it, you know, if you reach your limit on Lipitor, you know, this would help. But I'm just curious about this smRNA. Is this a brand, I know it's new, but is it because of the development of the COVID mRNA, or is this a, you know, completely different lane in the highway? Back to you, Ray.
Well, it's kind of a parallel lane, let's put it that way. RNA comes in different forms. Viruses carry their entire genetic code sequence in RNA. Our body will unsplice the nuclear DNA and make messenger RNA copies and then shuttle it out of the nucleus into organelles that manufacture proteins based on that. There is, in addition to messenger RNA, something called small interfering RNA, which is called siRNA. It does sort of the exact opposite. It inhibits expression of messenger RNA. So it's not that difficult to build siRNA if you know how to build messenger RNA. So they're building siRNA sequences that affect lipid control. And that's how they're managing the lower cholesterol side of it. So it's based on messenger RNA technology, but it utilizes something ever so slightly different than messenger RNA, which is the siRNA for small interfering RNA.
Okay. I'm just, you know, wondering if this has, you know, been developed because of that, you know. You know, I remember reading that they expect this mRNA to eventually start being used for other diseases. I think one was, I think you had one on about a week or two ago, you know, certain drugs are already starting to be developed, but I, you know, as far as I know, this is the first one that was approved, but I thought it was the same thing. So, okay, it's something different, but something along those lines. I wonder if this would have been developed if it wasn't for the mRNA, if this would have came out anyway. Back to you, Ron.
Well, my guess is it wouldn't. This is all kind of clustered around the ability that we now have to do gene sequencing rather efficiently and quickly, because it was only since the Human Genome Project that we even have the sequence for these cholesterol-producing DNA segments, and it took time to figure out what the segments were doing. Anyway, then it took time to figure out how to kind of manufacture almost basically handmade mRNA sequences. You could now go to a machine, dial in or download the RNA sequence that you want made into a messenger RNA and rebuild, reconstitute a vaccine for things. And messenger RNAs are good for manufacturing things that produce the proteins, mostly to just activate your own immune system. Problem is, messenger RNA doesn't inhibit anything. It just increases stuff. So you wouldn't want to flood your body with messenger RNA to manufacture the synthesis of cholesterol. That's why they sort of went back to the drawing board as far as the different types of RNA and found the inhibiting version. So you dial that in instead, and you're good to go. I see still going to be problems because it's most likely going to be an injection once again, but, you know, depending upon how effective and how often you have to inject people, it might be more suitable than a pill, although a lot of people really prefer pills.
Okay, understood. Very good. Thanks for that. Just one other quick question that they have not addressed since Omicron has come out, that I've heard anyway. I listen to the news a lot. I haven't heard, you go in, you get a test, okay, you got COVID, but now how do you know if you have Omicron or if you have Delta, you know? I understand it's two different Regenerons Regeneron is for COVID, but it's not gonna work for Delta, but it's not gonna work for Omicron. Now they have something else for Omicron. Does everybody know now when you go get tested which one you have? I mean, is the sequencing that good where, you know, it comes back, aha, you got Omicron. You go for this new monoclonal antibody system instead of the other one. Back you are.
No, unfortunately, the standard tests that they give for COVID do not differentiate the variants. You then have to take the viral samples and put them in a gene sequencer and actually go to the trouble of sequencing them. That's why there tends to always be a kind of delay on discovering that there's a new variant, and then when you get everyone worried and they start to increase the testing all over the world, they realize that it's been spreading for the last 3-4 weeks, not the last 3-4 days. So the short form is the routine tests that are used for whether or not a person is infected will not give a variant. You then have to decide whether it warrants testing for a variant. The way things look and the sampling that they seem to be getting is that the Omicron is now the dominant strain in the United States and will probably end up being 100% in maybe about 3-4 more weeks. So I do not know if they have monoclonal antibodies made up for the Omicron yet. So most likely it's going to be that they'll throw whatever they got at it for the time being, and by the time that it's not going to require any kind of double checking, they'll have the monoclonal antibodies that are better suited for Omicron.
KG2RY.
Okay, now I wrote one down. You know, they had it on the news, and I wrote the letters down. It was GTX. Or something. Anyway, AstraZeneca or something makes it, and that was supposed to be, that's now going to be used for Omicron, although there's not a big supply of it yet, and they're going to not give you Regeneron if you have Omicron. That's the latest I heard. That was about 3 days ago. Back to you.
Yes, apparently it's of little benefit, but yeah, the GTX, my guess again, is that over the next few weeks, it's going to be overwhelmingly Omicron. It seems to be incredibly more infectious than the Delta or the Alpha But it's so far it's less deadly. You know, they're throwing around 50% less deadly, 60% less deadly. You know, it's very difficult to figure it out because you have some people who are completely immunized, some people who are partially immunized, and some people who aren't at all immunized and different ages. So eventually, as time goes on, we'll have a better understanding of the risks to life and just long-term disabilities and such. But yeah, they're working on it. They're going to crank up production of it. It's going to be another method, but still, if you're out there listening, please get the messenger RNA vaccines, get the messenger RNA vaccine boosters. They're much more effective, unfortunately, than the Johnson & Johnson was, or the others that the Chinese and the Russians are depending upon. David, you wanted to say something?
QSL, Dr. Roy. Is there a difference between the symptoms of Omicron and all the other ones? What I heard, maybe I'm wrong, that Omicron, you have more like cold symptoms, and it's not as serious as the other variants.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, that is the best guess at this point. We have not had enough time with enough varied population groups to definitively say one thing or the other. You have to realize that since this is later on in the time scale, we're dealing with a somewhat different population. We're dealing with, especially in the United States, again, I see all kinds of percentages thrown all over the place. I read an article in the New York Times where 15% of adults are unvaccinated, yet I read someplace else that 60% of Americans are vaccinated, but I'm not quite sure if that includes the booster, because I also read that 25% of adults have had the booster. So they're all over the place. But the bottom line is, people are differently immunized now than they were 3 or even 6 months ago. And so just drawing a direct corollary with hospitalizations and death may not be the most accurate way of assessing the relative risk of the different variants. Right now, as you mentioned, it appears that it's a milder case of infection, but you know, time will tell ultimately when we get more numbers of people who are totally unvaccinated, so that'll give us a better sense of what the percentages are. Right now, they're thrown together with all the other people who are variably been vaccinated or pre-infected and such, so it confuses things.
Thank you, Dr. Roy.
Welcome, David. Any other questions out there? Okay, apparently no more questions. I'll bring up an old topic that I scribbled in my notes to talk about and never really got to. There was an interesting article that's on the link page from about a month or two ago where they have started to figure out how to use stem cells to treat type 1 diabetes. Now, type 1 diabetes is failure of autoimmune disorder that kills off your pancreatic islet cells that produce insulin. So those people require insulin injections for the rest of their lives. It's a terrible existence. You know, you have to check on your sugar, and then you have to adjust your insulin as required. We have more than a few people out there probably who have type 1 diabetes. So this is really interesting research. They were able to coax the stem cell into producing pancreatic, into producing insulin. So they were giving people stem cell treatment, and they were able to produce their own endogenous insulin, effectively treating their own diabetes. You do not have to monitor your blood sugar because the cells themselves will will excrete a certain amount of insulin based upon the serum sugar. The only problem is they haven't quite figured out how to get your own stem cells. So these are third-party stem cells, and you are stuck taking immunosuppressants the rest of your life. It's like taking a, it would be as if you had a